Beyond is sponsored by the Malone Society, whose works help keep alive the plays we work on. The Malone Society regularly publishes volumes of early plays which otherwise might not be available. To join the Society or find out more about their publications, go to malonesociety.com for more information. Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast, and today it's a chat about a play from the early years of the reign of Henry VIII, which both people in this particular Zoom room have done a fair amount of work on relatively lately. At the time of recording this in September, we're both on the other side of performing this play in very different contexts and different parts of the world. So without further ado, to go over to your side of the pond, who are you and what is your purpose in life?
I don't know if I have a purpose in life. My name is Jeff Daly. I'm, well, if people ask why they do, the easy answer is I'm retired. But in my retirement, I'm doing all the things I didn't have time to do during when I was working. So among them being some theater. I'm known as a director and a scholar of early English theater, what at least here is often referred to as pre-Shakespearean, which can mean, I guess, anything you want it to. So that's kind of it. I had the opportunity this past summer to give an off-Broadway production of The Interlude of Youth at a theater in Midtown Manhattan in New York City called the American Theater of Actors. And it was an interesting experience. I had been looking at doing a morality play for quite a while, having done all other genres of medieval and early Renaissance theater. It was hard to figure out what exactly to do, because the best known morality play, at least here, is Everyman. Mm. And that is still, although I don't think it's performed much at all, but is still read in most college courses on English drama, on English literature, in just in survey courses also, so that many people are familiar with it. The problem with Everyman is it's not a good example of a morality play, because the title character is already dead, so he doesn't have the opportunity to change his ways as a morality play would require him to. Not, and the other thing is, quite honestly, it's rather dull. I really wanted to like it. I really wanted to do it because I felt there was a lot of a name recognition in Everyman. And the fact that it is performed so regularly at the Salzburg Festival in German translation, but is a big hit there. But I have not been able to enjoy it very much. So I looked at other morality plays from around the same time. And this is a process that has gone on for the past decade. So I'm not thinking that I moved into it quickly and decided to do The Interlude of Youth. And we gave a run of 10 performances of it in August at this theater in Midtown Manhattan, and successfully, as far as I can tell.
Yes. I will defend Everyman a little bit. It is a very beautiful play in many ways, and very moving. In but you're absolutely right. It's got a joke in it. There is one line that you can play funny, and maybe two. There's two lines you can sort of do that sort of work. And they're quite early on in the play, and then it is unrelentingly serious for the rest of the text. And that is not what most morality plays are like, because they often have sequences of people sinning, basically. And these are often quite enjoyable things, because sinning is not unenjoyable. And so it's not very representative at all. And youth is we've talked about it in when we were preparing the play ourselves. I sort of talked about it as a sort of baby's first interlude. If you want to look at a moral interlude, it's not too long of an example. It's quite condensed. It ticks all of the boxes that you sort of expect from the form. And it doesn't present too many of the more outlandish staging issues. It's very simple in its staging, or at least what the script, you know, denotes to us. So yeah, in terms of what sort of attracted to it, I mean, beyond the fact that it has some humour and life to it in a way that Every Man as has a lot of death to it.
Well, the other thing is, unlike a lot of the morality plays that exist, that survive in Manuscript, is complete. There's no missing pages, as there are or with Mankind or the Castle of Perseverance. You know, as you yourself just said, it is compact. It goes from beginning, middle to end. And I think it fits the bill if you're thinking of it as just a dinner time entertainment. And one of the things we did in our production was we projected a scene of a great hall in a manor house as our scenery, because the idea was the first course is over, now it's time for some entertainment, let's bring out the actors.
It's quite explicitly the kind of entertainment that might have occurred in that context in the early years of Henry VIII. It's quite self-explanatory what it's about as well. I mean, you know, the title does tell us what's going on here.
Before each performance, I gave an introduction to the play. And I did this because I stopped doing written program notes some years ago because I don't want people spending the entire performance reading what I've written. So I do my program notes as verbal notes ahead of time. And so I explain because here in the United States, I'm sure morality plays are not as well known as they might be in the UK, exactly what you will be seeing. And one of the things that I pointed out is that in morality plays, there are no surprises. We all know how it's going to end.
Yeah.
Okay. So the question is, how is it going to get to that point? That's really the only question in all of the morality plays that exist.
At what point will he hit redemption and that arc is very much in place. I mean, we have very much the same thoughts when we were presenting it ourselves, as like, how do we present this? And we did do a sort of introduction. It wasn't an individual address. We tried something to draw, partly because we were doing a season as well. So it was like, we wanted to give everyone enough context, not just for that play, but for all of the other plays that come out of Henry's reign, which are all quite different, actually, in many ways, within these sort of genre constraints. But yeah, impressing on an audience that there are no surprises here. It's not about what's happening, it's about how the play does it and what it does around it. I mean, we've got our Tudor interlude bingo card as well, so we actually have the option for the audience, if they wanted to play along at home, to tick off the various things that vices and virtues might tend to do in a play. Getting that across to an audience is one of the big problems with early Tudor drama.
Well, as I explained to the audience before each performance, I said any play that has characters named Riot and Lechery guarantee you a good time.
Yes, it's like the vices are automatically, though of course the term doesn't technically quite exist for them at this point, are much more fun than a character called Charity. We can assume that Charity is less enjoyable. The play opens with Charity and basically gets barreled into by the arrival of youth. And it's that initial moment of someone effectively sermonizing, and then youth just careers into the room. And there was something about the nature of the character of Youth who does... Okay, the terms of reference are different, but there's something about the way that Youth is not really aware of other people. And I do wonder if that's is very in their own head. I wonder if that was something that you came across, the character of Youth within the play, that might connect with people today.
Well, I just think, first of all, a Youth is a very impetuous person and a very narcissistic person. As you pointed out, his opening entrance, and we had it stage where he came and he knocked Charity off his chair.
Yes, as
when he came in, because he doesn't even care who's in the same room with him. I think actually Youth speaks very well to contemporary people, because we all know people like that who are so preoccupied with themselves they don't realize what is going on around them. The good thing was in the interlude of Youth, he actually changes his mind about that and becomes aware of other people and the world in general, and adapts to it. I think one of the biggest shortcomings of the play is the fact that Youth's turnaround comes very quickly. It's like, it's not subtle at all. It's from one minute he's riotous and the next minute he's pious. And it goes right to that. And that you can understand that as being part of basically dinner theater. Okay, it was time to get on with the next course and end this. So, perhaps if it had been prepared for performance in some other means, the character of Youth may have changed a little more subtly, which obviously does not happen here. But the other thing is, I think at that point, everyone's ready for the play to end. So, because as you pointed out, everyone knows what the ending's going to be. So I don't think people are overly upset by that.
No, and I think it is. I mean, it turns up in morality plays rather a lot of that sudden vault face of turning that turnaround at the moment, like the road to Damascus moment of sudden conversion. Yeah. And it happens. So it seems maybe it's more that it's a conventional effect that, again, we've lost, that we just because we don't know those conventions. But it does come out more out of the blue, I think, in Youth than most others. There's usually at least some sort of spectacular thing happens, and they go, oh, I see the light. Yeah. Here he just kind of just immediately changes his mind. And certainly the actors did try to find ways to make a bit of a journey in that final scene. And there is something... It's actually almost like an inversion of the summoning of Everyman, actually, at the end, where the vices are really... seem quite genuinely hurt that he's turned to God. Yeah. They actually genuinely seem upset that their friend and co-roisterer has decided to go away.
Well, I think definitely, if not that they're offended that he turned to God, they are annoyed or saddened even by the loss of a friend. Because I think in both cases, both with Pride and especially with Riot, there's the thought that we've known each other for a long time. Why would you do this to me? It's interesting that Youth doesn't attempt to convert them.
No.
He just says, it's time for you to leave. He doesn't even say, well, you could stay if you change your ways. It's kind of interesting. The way that goes. Especially since by the end of the play, Charity has become such an annoying character that, you can't imagine anyone listening to him at this point, because he's been saying the same thing for most of the entire play, except for the one portion there he's off stage. Charity probably has more to say than anyone else in the play. Mm. And, you know, he is the one who's saying the same thing over and over again. Mm. And it's perhaps that he is kind of like tag teamed with humility towards the end, that it finally begins to sink in. And then, like we said, all of a sudden you says, oh, that's what you mean. Okay. Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, we demonstrate, just so you know, from a staging perspective, mm. we demonstrated that by where Charity says, well, here's a new habit for you. I don't remember the exact words.
Yeah.
And we had to bring out a church vestment at that point.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, to kind of show this big change that's happening.
And I think what's actually really interesting about Charity, so again, for the listeners at home, you know, Charity opens it and basically Hector's youth. It's like the sort of a young person and not necessarily a parent, but maybe you're, you know, a teacher who is there, and they're not communicating with each other at all. There's no communication. And the only thing, it doesn't take much for youth to change, because all they need in the room is a little humility. And that's, religious doctrine aside, is not an inherently bad analogy for growing up, is developing a little bit of humility to go, actually, the world isn't revolving around me. And that's one of the reasons I think the play is actually really clever. In actually, there's humility is trying a different approach to Charity, who all he can do is Hector, and do that, and he goes, actually, no, I need a different approach. I need to do something a little subtler, and he needs to get somebody else to do that for him. And that seemed to be where the heart of that change came in.
Yes, I think, I mean, the character of humility is vitally important to the play. It could almost be that he is the character that shows that even though Charity is ranting endlessly, that it's like, well, here's a rational person who's saying the same thing. So maybe there is something in this.
Mm. Mm. And of course, I don't know if this is how our audience took it or for you. Because Charity gets set upon by the by Pride and Riot and youth, and gets chained up. And there's a part of me wondering whether the audience is moderately glad that that moment happens. I think
would have been more glad if he was gagged.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because he's left alone on stage to do a little speech. I mean, it's and again, that's a very conventional, that again is a form that turns up in quite a few plays. Either the good, inverted queries, good character is either banished or locked away in some fashion, so that the personification figure, so in this case youth, can go off and do what they want with the bad characters. And so, yeah, so that sort of sense of goodness being put to one side is an opportunity there for action to occur.
But also, just in my thinking, especially since our performance at the American Theater Actors, we were the last production of their 49th season. Mm. And their 50th season started this month with King Lear. Mm. And the chaining up scene in Youth, I think, presages the pillorying scene in King Lear, where it's the same thing. You you chain up a character, but you let him keep speaking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we haven't really talked very much about the relationship. So of Pride and Riot. We saw Riot as sort of like a, not maybe necessarily a literal older brother, but someone a few years with a little more experience. You know, if you think of at school, for example, you might have someone a year or two senior who's terribly cool and does all the the stuff that you look up to on some level. And that's sort of how we saw Riot in the play, as an identification figure for youth to look up to. And maybe there are moments when you think Riot's going a bit too far, which is a slightly different relationship to Pride. Pride is more of an outsider to the group. I mean, he seems to be brought in to teach him the ropes.
Well, I think the thing that has to come across is that, and because Youth does talk about this also, that Youth knows Riot already. Because he says, I wish my friend Riot were here. Yeah. And so he's completely talking to him about as a friend, you know, so that there is at least some connection there already. Whereas Pride is introduced during that scene. And so they are newly found new friends there. But the other thing is, it's made very clear that Pride works for Youth. He is being hired as and again, there's an analogous scene in King Lear where was it Kent in disguise is hired by King Lear. So you know, the fact is, in English society at this point, it was not unusual for the servant class to work for wealthier people. And in this case, you know, Youth makes it clear right from his first entrance that he is an inheritor of all his father's land. So we know that he is wealthy, and he basically can do whatever he wants. And that's the whole idea behind the play, is showing this person with money how he should be behaving. That just because you have money doesn't mean you can be reckless with it or with anything else.
Yes, because he's just gained money, it's like Pride comes in and goes, well, this is how you spend it. You need to make sure you get some good clothes. This hat is not good enough. this is what you need to wear. And there's almost a fake it till you'll make it mentality to it. You know, you need to just, once you put on the clothes, and everyone will start respecting you, and you just have to be terribly rude to the other servant, to the servants. And that's how we do. That's how our society works, you know.
And he also says, then you have to get married. And that's what starts the argument between Pride and Riot about that. I wonder if that was not just a theatrical move so that they could bring the woman on stage. And the one question that I have about this play is how it... Well, that's not true. I have many questions about this play, but is how different it would be with a man playing Lechery as with a woman. We went with, now I know originally there was one actor and he played both Humility and Lechery. And obviously at a time when all actors were male, no one questioned this. We did it with a separate actor, a man for Lechery, for Humility, and a woman who played Lechery. Even though it's really not a very big part when you know, because it's like one third of an actor's part. But you know, and so from an audience perspective, it was very believable at that point that Youth would be very attracted to Lechery. And I don't know, when you did you do it with a man or a woman?
With a woman. So, and we doubled Lechery with Humility. So we maintained the double, but we didn't attempt an original practice sort of logic to it. And yeah, it's interesting that the way Lady Lechery functions, you know, because she comes on, and it's like, because they are functioning a bit like con artists in the sense that they come on and he says, "Oh, this is Lady Lechery," and he said, "No, you're not supposed to tell him that. You know, I'm just a respectable woman I am, kind of logic. And yeah, demonstrating, you know, who she is as being very differently costumed to humility later on, so that, you know, there is no confusion for the audience as well that you know, these are very different.
Well, and one of the things that I've been thinking about is how much time humility, lechery would take to turn from humility and back again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did it mean, you know, extra rouge on the face, a wig, obviously fake breasts of some sort. You know, it's interesting, but in this day and age, a man coming out dressed as a woman, especially one who has to make up in very quick, you know, in a very short amount of time, would obviously look very differently. And the audience would, I think, react very differently. And they would see it more on the level of farce. Whereas by having a woman do it, as I think I may have referred to before, this became very realistic. And I felt there were really, youth at least had very realistic feelings for lechery.
Oh, yeah.
Now, she said the same thing back to him. Whether she actually felt it, oh, you know, we'll never know. It was that didn't develop, but I felt it could have. And it was a very realistic sort of thing that could have worked out.
Well, I mean, the way the relationship of the three, Pride, Riot, and Lady Lechery, suggests to say that they are working you for his money, and that, you know, she's part of effectively a con artist ring. Yeah. I mean, it's pre, I don't know when the term coney catching is coined. It's certainly later Elizabethan, but it's that setup. I mean, we see it in the Robert Greene pamphlets all the time of that sort of structure of working the mark, and that's sort of how we saw that relationship actually. At that point, becoming quite explicit that what they're doing is milking him for the cash, because the way they work him is they go, "Oh, of course, no, don't worry, we'll get all the drinks in when we go to the tavern. It's fine, it's all on us." And then he, of course, the reverse psychology of no, I've just got all my father's money, I'll pay, it's fine, and it's just quietly taking the money away from him, and it's like that was the plan all along. The play doesn't make him. As it doesn't bring him down to destitution.
No.
It's interesting. We don't have with many morality plays. You drag the central character down to really down to earth, to the point of despair, even possibly contemplating, you know, suicide. And that, you know, and then there's that turnaround. Whereas here, the stakes don't seem to be quite as high.
Well, because it's not a play about money. It's a play about spirituality.
Mm.
And so that it gets to the point almost where after they come back from the tavern, you know, there's no discussion of money at all from that point. Mm. Unless you consider the many ways that Riot has shows youth he can play cards and he can play dice. But again, that's not developed as to whether or not that is played for money.
I think that's more about just demonstrating a bad way of life that you shouldn't follow, and you know, look, we're really skilled in this, and so you performed it a number of times for a modern audience. In terms of your staging and responses, what did you find actually doing it?
Well, first of all, in speaking with some of the actors, they said it was very difficult.
Mm.
Now, I'm not sure if that's because they were just unfamiliar with doing verse drama, which is something, at least in the United States, that you know, the study of Shakespeare and so on is not what it once was. But it could also be the fact that the verse is not regular. It's not like it's iambic pentameter all the time. It changes a lot. It changes meter. At times it rhymes. At times it doesn't rhyme. At times it probably one time did rhyme, but doesn't rhyme anymore in modern English. Not to mention the fact there are some words in it that are not currently being used. And so it's up to the actor to get that feeling across. You know, we occasionally just simplified language and just, you know, if it's a matter of one letter or so sound changing, we did that. But on the whole, we kept it in the early 16th century text. And so it's a matter of getting that across to it. Now, like I said beforehand, I did talk about tell the audience what some of the words mean. Like, for example, for an American audience, the term "ewis" is not encountered at all. And in this play, it's like every third line. You know, you have to get that. So there are some words that are not there. And for this, I turned to the actors to say to them, what don't you understand? Because as a scholar, it all makes sense to me.
Yeah. I mean, that's part of the process of our readings is, you know, being open to everyone is because it's like people coming in and going, but I don't know what this stuff is. And go, no, that's why you're here. Yeah. You're to remind us of what we've learned, you know, to that difference. Because, yeah, it's so easy for us to go in and forget that, you know, most people don't know what X, Y, or Z is in a play like this.
Yeah. And the other thing was, in my introduction, I also translated all the Latin that they would be hearing it. Because, again, at the time this was written, you could imagine that most of the audience understood Latin from their schooling. And they may not have remembered all of it, but they would have known enough, especially since most of it in this play is either a paraphrase or a direct quote from a biblical text.
Yeah, they would be hearing Latin in church and about in a way that we just don't anymore. And most of them, you say this, they're not excessively complicated bits of Latin. But I say the knowledge base isn't there, so just having that something to lean on there is really useful. How do you think the audience, the cast you were saying, you know, found it difficult? Did it seem to work? I mean, we never really know how, you know, an audience takes things. But,
You know, people did come up to me afterwards and thank me and saying, I didn't know this existed. You know, it's good to see it. We did advertise through an organization in New York called the Gotham Early Music Scene, which has an audience of people interested in early music. Not that we performed any music live, except for a drunken song in the play. But we did play recordings of music at length beforehand and afterwards. So you got the ambiance of it. And so there were people who were interested in history in that period who came. There's some people may have left without saying anything, but there were people who made it a point to come and talk to me afterwards because they knew I was the director because I gave the speech at the beginning of each performance, to discuss it with me. So I feel that's a good thing. You know, there may have been people who were, there were people who walked out during the performance, which considering the play is half an hour long, it seemed kind of silly to me. And I did not ask them why they were leaving, it could just be, you know, they had to go to the bathroom or something. So, you know,
I think we have to acknowledge that, you know, this kind of drama is not for everyone. And if they haven't fully realized what they're coming in for, then, you know, that's not actually a wholly unreasonable response, so long as it's a minor percentage of the audience.
Our publicity people use some services here that are what we call here papering, which is to give out free tickets to increase the number of people in the theater. You know, these people may not have had a financial reason to stay for, you know, for the whole thing, even though, like I said, it wasn't a long play. You know, we started at 8 o'clock or a little bit afterward, and everyone was out by 9. So, it was not a big deal. But, you know, but on the whole, I felt, you know, the people who seemed to like it, I mean, they all laughed at the right places. They clapped at the right places. You know, again, people came up to talk to me afterwards about it. Some of the things written about it, you know, like, oh, gee, I never knew things like this existed. Again, in the United States, at least, there is far, well, I mean, medieval literature is not well known, in medieval drama, even less known than that. And the subset of medieval drama being the morality play is even lesser known than anything. So, you know, it's really, as far as experts in this, it's a very specialized audience. And when you're performing a play off Broadway, the idea is not to, we're not performing specialists. And especially since we did it in the summer when there were no college classes. So, you know, it wasn't like we could even, you know, encourage them to come. You know, it was, so I would say, you know, on the whole, the storyline, like we have mentioned before, is pretty straightforward. So it's not like you won't understand that. You know, the language can at times be a little tricky, but with good actors, I don't think that was, you know, a problem. Our actor who played youth was from Norway. He speaks English, you know, fluently, but his parents came to see it from Norway. And what he told me afterwards is, you know, because I asked him how his father liked it, and his father, you know, had a little trouble understanding it for, you know, as someone who knows English only from a foreign language, you know, it's a little tricky. But I think on the whole, there's enough action in the play that even if you don't pick up on all the words, you can figure out what's going on and still have a really good time.
Yes. There are, again, some of this is less easy to do now than it would have been, you know, hundreds of years ago. But there are clear sort of visual signals for each of these characters, you know, in terms of, you know, this the virtues versus the vices, and making that getting that across. It has a certain straightforwardness to its visuals. In the climax, you think that the climax is, there are two on one side, two on the other side, and youth is piggy in the middle. And I wanted in our production to get that across like it was a bit of a tug of war. I'd love to say that we quite realised that. I don't think we did, partly because the stage was a little too narrow, so we couldn't quite get that to work. It is a trickier play than it looks. In many ways, actually, of getting the detailing right, making those details land with all of those little barriers that we're discussing. But I continue to work on it myself, and hopefully, you know, we will come back with another version ourselves. And I hope other people out there will come up with their own versions and be inspired. And if there's anything we can do to make that happen, you know, get in touch. We're here for other people to work on these plays as well as ourselves. And we have a host of materials that hopefully will be useful to you, as indeed do you, because you have archived a fair amount of this online.
Yes. Yes, we did record one performance, and which includes my introduction. You know how good it is. It would have been better if we had recorded multiple performances and could have chosen the best pieces of it, and perhaps from different camera angles. This was basically just one video camera right in the middle. So it's almost like you were attending at a dinner, being there, because it was only one set, but one viewpoint. But on the whole, I think from an archival perspective, we have recorded, you know, the entire play. You know, I would hope that people with an interest in English theater history would become familiar with this play, because like I said, it does have many of the precursors that we find in Shakespeare and in Marlowe. The good angel, bad angel thing in Dr. Faustus is the same as we see here with the good characters and the bad characters. He's trying to get someone to do things their way. The whole idea of youth being, giving up corruption to become respectable, that is basically the plot of both parts of Henry IV by Shakespeare. It's an interesting piece. And there's enough comedy in it, I think, both to make it interesting for the audience and for the actors. It was, I think the actors really had a good time doing this, because there's a lot of stuff to play around with here.
So links for all of those things will be in the show description. Hopefully we will be able to return to this play again in the future. If you'd like to hear more of us talking about plays, there's another episode of us chatting on the podcast about John Bale. So you can always have a dip into the archive. That link will also be in the show description. So all of early Tudor drama is available.
Yes. Well, I mean, this is the Interlude of Youth is a lot less dogmatic than John Bale.
I think most
plays, not as dogmatic as John Bale. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
And speak again soon.